Those of us acquainted with their sordid and scandalous story were not surprised to hear, by way of rumors from the various localities where the sorceresses had settled after fleeing our pleasant town of Eastwick, Rhode Island, that the husbands, whom the three godforsaken women had by their dark arts concocted for themselves, did not prove durable. Wicked methods make weak products. Satan counterfeits creation, yes, but with inferior goods. Alexandra, the oldest in age, the broadest in body, and the nearest in character to normal, generous-spirited humanity, was the first to become a widow. Her instinct, as with so many a wife suddenly liberated into solitude, was to travel. As if the world at large, by way of flimsy boarding cards and tedious airport delays, and the faint but undeniable risk of flight in a time of rising fuel costs, airline bankruptcy, suicidal terrorists, and accumulating metal fatigue, could be compelled to yield the fruitful aggravation of having a mate. Jim Farlander, the husband she had conjured for herself from a hollowed pumpkin, a cowboy hat, and a pinch of western soil scraped from inside the back fender of a pickup truck with Colorado plates that she had seen parked, looking eerily out of place, on Oak Street in the early 1970s, had, as their marriage settled and hardened, proved difficult to budge from his ceramic studio and little frequented pottery shop on a side street in Taos, New Mexico. Jim's idea of a trip had been the hour's drive south to Santa Fe. His idea of a holiday was spending a day in one of the Indian reservations, Navajo, Zuni, Apache, Acoma, Isleta Pueblo, spying out what the Native American potters were offering in the reservation's souvenir shops, and hoping to pick up cheap in some dusty Indian Bureau commissary an authentic old black-and-white geometric Pueblo jar, or a red-on-buff Huhukam storage jar, with its spiral and maze pattern, which he could peddle for a small fortune to a newly endowed museum in one of the burgeoning resort cities of the Southwest. Jim liked where he was, and Alexandra liked that in him, since she, as his wife, was part of where he was. She liked his lean build, a flat stomach to the day he died, and never performed a sit-up in his life, and the saddle smell of his sweat, and the scent of clay that clung like a sepia aura to his strong and knowing hands. They had met on the natural plane when she, for some time divorced, had taken a course at the Rhode Island School of Design, where he had been enlisted as a fill-in instructor. The four stepchildren, Marcy, Ben, Linda, Eric, that she saddled him with, couldn't have asked for a calmer, more soothingly taciturn father substitute. He was easier for her children, half out of the nest in any case, Marcy being all of 18, to relate to than their own father, Oswald Spofford, a small manufacturer of kitchen fixtures from Norwich, Connecticut. Poor Ozzy had become so earnestly involved in Little League baseball and company bowling that no one, not even his children, could take him seriously. People had taken Jim Farlander seriously, women and children especially, giving him back his own poised silence. His level gray eyes had the glint of a gun from within the shade of his wide-brimmed hat, its crown darkened where his thumb and fingers pinched it. When he was at the pottery wheel, he tied a faded blue bandana around his head to keep his long hair, gray but still streaked with its original sun-bleached auburn, and gathered behind into an 8-inch ponytail, out of the clay, wet and spinning on the foot-powered wheel. A fall in his teens from a horse had left him with a limp, and the wheel, which he refused to electrify, limped with him, while out of the spinning, his masculine hands shaped blobs upward into graceful vessels with slender waists and swelling bottoms. It was in bed she first felt his death coming. His erections began to wilt, just as she might have come if he had held on. Instead, in his body upon hers, there was a palpable loosening in the knit of his sinews. There had been a challenging nicety in the taut way Jim dressed himself, pointy vanilla-colored boots, butt-hugging jeans with rivet-bordered pockets, and crisp checked shirts double-buttoned at the cuff. Once a dandy of his type, he began to wear the same shirt 2 and even 3 days in a row. His jaw showed shadows of white whisker underneath, from careless shaving or troubled eyesight. When the ominous blood counts began to arrive from the hospital, and the shadows in the X-rays were visible to even her untrained eyes, he greeted the news with stoic lassitude. Alexandra had to fight to get him out of his crusty work clothes into something decent. They had joined the legion of elderly couples who fill hospital waiting rooms, as quiet with nervousness as parents and children before a recital. She felt the other couples idly pawing at them with their eyes, trying to guess which of the two was the sick one, the doomed one. She didn't want it to be obvious. She wanted to present Jim as a mother presents her child going to school for the first time, as a credit to her. They had lived, these 30-plus years since she had lived in Eastwick, by their own rules up in Taos. There the free spirits of the Lawrences and Mabel Dodge Luhan still cast a sheltering cachet over the remnant tribe of artistic wannabes, a hard-drinking, new-age, superstitious, artsy-craftsy crowd who aimed their artifacts, in their shop-window displays, more and more plaintively at scrimping low-brow tourists rather than the well-heeled local collectors of southwestern art.